I would say like semi-digital nomad or something like that.
Okay. Now, are you a semi-digital nomad or a semi-nomadic digital?
I don't even know.
I don't, a semi-digital nomad. Like, you only use computers half the time?
He's nomadic who's digital. No, he's sometimes nomadic. I don't know.
I did use an analog camera for a while. I was on an analog camera kick, so.
Hello, and welcome to episode number 104 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I don't know what day it is. Just realized that. Cut.
Well, I'm on a different... No, we can keep going. I'm on a different day than you, so it doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think we're going to release a show on the 3rd Thursday. Of March. Yeah, Thursday, 3rd of March. And Seth is recording a day ahead of us, so there's that.
So where I am, it's already your birthday, Stephen. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Oh, happy early birthday.
Thank you very much. And that voice you hear is our guest, Jonathan Koo. Jonathan is a semi-digital nomad, a programmer, kind of a work-from-anywhere guy once a month, and an explorer of abandoned places, which is a topic I love. So welcome to the show, Jonathan. Glad to have you on.
Well, thanks for having me. It's actually a big honor, so thank you.
Yeah. And, of course, Seth Miller.
Wait, really?
It is.
Sorry, can we cut that out?
And then we have Seth Miller, of course, live from Bangkok. So it's great to have everyone.
It's also an honor.
Yeah. Are you honored, really?
I am.
That's good.
I appreciate you guys were willing to accommodate my schedule.
Oh, it worked out great. I mean, being in Bangkok, it's what, 7 a.m. there now?
8 a.m.
8 a.m., and it's 5 o'clock here in the West Coast, and it's kind of perfect.
Yeah, no, it's exactly 12 hours off in New York and Bangkok right now, so my brain is pretty confused.
Yeah.
But.
Jonathan, I want to ask you a question, since one of your titles that we gave you introducing you was Work From Anywhere Once a Month, and so this is something that you kind of adhere to. If people follow you on Twitter, once a month you're going somewhere, and you're working from there usually and exploring at the same time. Tell me a little bit about that.
So that's sort of my goal or my usual schedule, I guess, that I try to stick to. So, for about the past 10 years, well, almost 10 years, I've worked from home, for a company on the East Coast. And I sort of realized like 3 or 4 years ago that if I'm working from home, I might as well work from anywhere. So I usually try to do that once a month. Usually Europe works out best time wise because I do have fixed hours. I do need to work. So I have to work East Coast business hours. So if I'm in Europe, I can go out and explore till about 2 or 3 o'clock. Then I start work at 3, which is like 9 o'clock Eastern. And then I work till I go to bed at around midnight. And yeah, so it's like half day of out and about and then half day of work. And it seems to work out pretty well.
Yeah, that's great. And how long usually are you in Europe? Is it a week?
So I'm usually gone a week at a time. Mm-hmm. And like I said earlier, I try for once a month. And yeah, it seems to work out well.
Yeah, that's cool. And do you have a favorite country or city in Europe that you continually go back to, or is it somewhere new every month?
Yeah, so I do try for new places. I'm not a country counter. I mean, I know approximately the number of countries I've been to, but I think of my travel as more experience counting. So usually new country means new experience. So I usually try for someplace new every time. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the same. It could be the same country, but not necessarily the same city. So, I still have yet to make it to the south of France, for instance. So I would love to go and, check that out. But I guess I sort of am running out of new countries in Europe to go to, but yeah.
It's a good problem.
It is a good problem.
Have you, go ahead, Seth.
Sorry, I was just saying, it's, from what I followed of your travels a bit, it seems like you've done a good chunk of Eastern Europe and sort of into the Caucasus a bit.
Yeah, so I used to live...
Which amazes me, because it seems like much harder travel.
Yeah, so I'm actually kind of lazy when it comes to that. So the Central Asia countries I've been to were the ones you don't need a visa for. So yeah. I'm usually too cheap or too lazy to apply for a visa. And so that also goes into, along with like ticket price, it goes into factoring. Those are the factors that in my decision making process of where I'm going to next. And it does tend to end up being more Eastern Europe now, only because in the past I've done like Central and Western Europe quite a bit, because I did used to live in Germany for 2 years when I went to grad school. So it was easier to get around Europe at that back then it was like 40 euro round trip airfares, so I took advantage of that. That's actually the reason why I went to grad school abroad, was just because I wanted an excuse to live somewhere else. So thank you, German government, for paying for my education that I don't use and you're not benefiting from.
Yeah, we'll blank that part out so that the German can...
It's a shame.
So have you done much of the Baltics, up in Estonia, Lithuania, that area?
Yeah, so I did do that a couple of times. So usually it's easier for me to spend a week in one place or one region, I suppose. So I've made several trips to the Baltics. So the ones that I do need to go sort of make up for now are the Balkans. So there's a lot of Southeast Europe that I still haven't been to. So I'm actually going to Serbia this weekend.
Oh,
and
nice.
Yeah, this was a very last minute trip. And so I've only been to Albania and Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Okay.
So, yeah, the rest of the Balkans are definitely up for grabs as well.
And now, Air Serbia hasn't started their JFK flights yet, right?
No, so I'm taking Air Serbia from Paris and then back through Dusseldorf, which who knew that Delta flew Dusseldorf to Atlanta, but they do.
So this is a Delta ticket then?
It's an Air France ticket, but I'm only flying one Air France flight from LAX to Paris, and then the rest are all Delta flights with Air France numbers, except for the Air Serbia.
And are you, just for our listeners, you're Bay Area based, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Correct. So West Coast like me, which I find Europe, I don't know if in your experience, but Europe to me is almost the longer trip. I've been on a few Asian flights recently, and to me they're almost easier flying to Asia.
Definitely.
Going east, I feel more beat up. Just this last trip in January, I felt really jet lagged for like 2 days in Europe, and that's very unusual for me.
Mm-hmm. I would actually do Asia a lot more, but because of work, I would have to end up pulling all-nighters, which I've done before, but it's really not pleasant. So
yeah,
I,
that'd
I,
be brutal.
I try to avoid it. Which it's hard not to avoid, though, because there were these cheap fares to Tokyo, and I really love Tokyo, so...
So yeah. when are you going?
I have no Asia trips planned as of yet.
Oh,
you didn't get in on the $400?
No, I was really thinking about it. I'm like, you know, for $400, I could stay up, you know, nights for a week. But ultimately,
it's a little awkward the ways we justify things like that.
Right.
Like my trip out here was LaGuardia, DFW, Hong Kong, Kuala Lumpur, and then an 8-hour overnight from like 1 to 9 a.m. I was like, oh, but it's only $450 for the ticket, and, you know, I don't have to really do anything the next day, so it's okay that I'm basically going to sleep in the airport terminal for 6 hours and then try to remember to wake up and catch my flight. It seems like a good idea, right?
Yeah, except your hotel didn't really pan out, right?
No, it didn't. There was a transit hotel in the Kuala Lumpur airport, and I had to transfer from the main terminal to the LCC terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh, there's a transit hotel, but it's inside security. So I didn't want to book it until I knew I was going to make the connection and all these other things. And then by the time I got there, I walked up to the counter. I'm like, hi, can I get a room, please? And then everyone was very polite in telling me they were sold out and to buzz off.
Ooh,
ouch.
So it turns out there's like a second pseudo hotel. I took a shower there. I paid for a shower because it had been far too long. And I got my shower in the airport hotel space because they allow that too. And then walked back and took a train back to the other half of the main terminal. And there was this, like, easy sleep beds place. And it was, like, literally a room 4 feet wide with bunk beds inside. And
wow.
But there was no one else in those bunk beds, right?
No, there's no one else in the other bunk.
Okay.
If you want people, you can get you get both bunks and you pay 50% more for the room. And, like, no bathrooms. Forget in the room. There were no bathrooms in the space. So when I woke up and needed to go to the bathroom, it was, like, put shoes on and walk across the terminal out to, like, the bathroom on the other side of the public space of the terminal. It was
seriously
sketchy. Yeah.
Is that where the shower...
Pretty cool,
were there,
right?
Were there showers?
No, not in the part I stayed in.
Oh, my God.
So the main transit hotel, I don't know if there were bathrooms in the rooms. I assume there are. There definitely was, like, a public shower area, which was, you know, individual stalls and whatever, but, you know, like an airport lounge-style individual stalls. You go and you get a shower thing. I assume that the rooms there also have individual full bathrooms. But I never got inside one to confirm that. So, and then
is that train new too?
So there's two. Yes, the train between the main and the LCC terminals is new, relatively speaking. I mean, my last time there was 4 or 5 years ago, and it did not exist.
Right, same here.
And you have to pay for it, which is a little obnoxious. But it's 2 ringgit, which I think is like 50 or 60 cents. So, and I was fortunate I had leftover ringgit from my trip 5 or 6 years ago, so I actually had the exact change cash. I imagine they would have let me pay with a credit card, but I didn't. So, yeah, it was interesting. And apparently the airline I flew is moving back to the main terminal, like, middle of the month. So it was only weird circumstance that had me have to switch anyways. But, yeah, so I don't know why I went down that road, but...
And so where are you in, where are you in Bangkok? Where are you staying?
I'm staying at the Hilton Millennium.
Oh, so it's a, your digs are a little bit better in Bangkok. It's not,
yeah.
You're not walking across the terminal.
No, to go to the bathroom, definitely not. It's actually a nice hotel. I'm impressed by the hotel. It's on the other side of the river, if you will. So not the side I normally stay on. And I'm learning to grow into that experience.
Just a different atmosphere where you're at?
Yeah, it's a different vibe. It's, you know, I won't say it's quite the same as going to the other side of the Bosphorus in Istanbul, where you get like that whole different, completely different vibe, but everything is a little more chill. There's a little less sort of tourist touts going on that I've experienced so far. There's just fewer tourists over here. I mean, there's still a bunch of hotels, but they're somewhat isolated, and then like a half block off the river, everything returns straight to sort of residential, commercial, really. Yeah, I'm actually looking out the window at like an abandoned shantytown in some way. it's nice in that context. I mainly did it because the conference I'm attending is hosted here, and I didn't want to be going back and forth across the river multiple times every day. I have to go to the other side of the river twice today for different events, and then again at least on Wednesday when I leave, and probably we'll end up doing it on Tuesday. So that plan didn't work out quite as well as I'd hoped, but here I am.
Oh, man. Well, since Jonathan, you're a kind of a traveler that has to work on the road, and Seth, you kind of do the same thing. You require connectivity. My question is, how do you stay connected? You're both Airbnb guys, just from following you on Twitter. And Jonathan, you post sometimes on Twitter about, you know, your stays and how gracious your hosts are. What's it like, though, when the connection doesn't work out or you lose power? Does that make your life all that much more difficult? I mean, are you then struggling to find a connection somewhere? And if you're in a remote place, how do you do that?
Yeah, so I've had some weird experiences with Airbnb lately, but I'm chalking that up to living like a local. Because there's like the same problems that locals would have faced. You know, it's like too much power being drawn on the electric grid or the circuit breakers or whatever. Or in another case, like the water stopped working in one of my Airbnbs for like a day. But yeah, in terms of electricity, that makes things hard because then the router goes down and I need to be connected for work. So luckily, in this case, what happened was it went down like right when I was waking up from my like mid-afternoon nap. This was in Madrid, and I didn't know what to do, and I sort of like bungled some Spanish, asking some random construction guys who were working in the building if they had anything to do with it, but they didn't. So I assumed it was just my apartment, and I really needed to go to work. So I was looking up alternatives, and there was a Regus close by. Is that how, I don't even know how you people say it, like Regus, whatever.
I know what you're talking
who
about.
Who are you people?
us like, podcasters, clearly so.
Or people who speak English in general. Every time I'm in Europe, they say like Regus or something, and I don't know. I would say like Regus, like Philbin. But anyways, there are these temporary office spaces, and I don't even know how I have a membership. I think it's through a credit card, but you get to work in their business lounges for free. And that can mean many different things, as I have come to discover over the course of many years. But yeah, so I went over to the Regus, managed to sit. They gave me a cubicle to work in, so I worked in the cubicle for a couple hours. I took the conference calls I needed to take. And in the meantime, I had messaged my Airbnb host, and she responded fairly quickly, saying that, oh, you know, you just need to flip all the circuit breakers off and back on again, and it's fine. So luckily, I went back, did the circuit breaker thing. It worked, you know, for a couple hours. So I'd have to keep, like, flipping the circuit breakers, like, every 2 hours. But at least I had internet, and I didn't have to, like, find an all-night cafe, which I've actually also done before because, the place I was in, the internet speeds were so slow, and I had to upload a big project for work, and it was so pokey slow that it would have taken like 3 hours to upload. So I went down to a local cafe. This was like at 8 o'clock at night, I think, actually in one of the Baltic states or Baltic countries, and uploaded the file, had a cup of coffee, and then went back to the apartment and got the rest of my work done. So
I've done that before.
Yeah, so having a phone where you can like find local cafes or Regus's or whatever workspaces that have internet, that's really key.
Have you found?
Yeah, and I think in that context, though, I think you take a different approach than me. I'm a T-Mobile guy. We were talking before we started recording that I'm in Bangkok, so I'm online, even if it's at crappy 2G speeds. And it's been challenging here this week, but, you know, I'm sure I'll survive. But you see, I think from reading and following you, you seem to be a guy that gets a local SIM most places you go.
Yeah, so I do get a local SIM. I also have, so work actually pays for my phone, but Verizon cut off their, like, great deal for international travel for businesses many years ago.
Yeah.
So since then, I've actually paid for a separate T-Mobile SIM that I use when I travel. But I sort of use that as a stopgap measure until I can get a local SIM. Just because I've lived with a 2G SIM. I won't do work over a 2G connection, but I've lived with a T-Mobile SIM card for a week. And it's totally doable. But sometimes when you're just trying to make sure that your tweet gets posted with a picture, it can be a little hard. And
priorities.
Right.
I like
exactly.
Your priorities.
And I've noticed that because the connection is so slow and I want to make sure that things post correctly, I keep the phone on for longer, and that makes the battery run out quicker. At least that's just in my experience. But certainly in places where it's difficult to get a SIM card, I'll stick with the T-Mobile, or if it's expensive, like I'm actually a cheapskate when it comes to SIM cards. I'm not going to spend like $35 for a week. That's too rich for my blood for connectivity when I can, you know, I can deal with a 2G connection for a week. But yeah, in most places I do look for a local SIM. It usually ends up being quite a bit cheaper. So I don't know. The prices do fluctuate, but you can get like $10 will get you a gigabyte. And yeah.
And so in Europe, do you find that to be pretty consistent around Europe, particularly like Eastern Europe, finding a SIM card? Is that pretty easy?
It's pretty easy. But I was actually very glad to go back to Spain again, because if you get the Orange SIM card, like from the company Orange, it's not an Orange SIM card, you can get €1 roaming in all EU countries. And that's every 100 megabytes is €1. And it's a daily thing. So if you use like 10 megabytes on day one and 10 megabytes on day two, they'll charge you €1 each day. But I had this card from a previous trip and I lost it. So I was really happy to get it back again. So
pretty reasonable pricing wise.
Yeah. So I usually budget 100 megabytes a day. But that was before I started Snapchatting. So maybe I should budget a little bit more now. but yeah, it's 100 megabytes for €1. And if there's a 4G network available, it'll go on 4G as well.
Oh, wow. Cause I think, I was having this conversation with Seth and some other friends of mine about, switching to T-Mobile. Should I do it? I have, AT&T, and I used to have a very nice business travel plan. So I just go to Europe and let them know, and it was unlimited data overseas, which was great, and it worked pretty much everywhere. And then I'm no longer with that company, so I don't have that benefit anymore. And I was talking to folks, and they were like, "Well, AT&T is good in the Pacific Northwest. T-Mobile's terrible, and so I need the phone to mostly work here." I'm torn. And do you carry around a bunch of SIM cards? Because that's like the one thing that
I do carry a bunch of SIM cards. And I actually don't use T-Mobile at home. It just sort of like sits in a temporary phone that just uses up U.S. data, like in the background, just like an old phone that just does updates. Just so I'm hoping they don't cut me off, because I only pay for the cheapest data plan that has no voice. So you can't call me when I'm abroad unless you do like Google Voice or Skype or something. But yeah, so yeah, it's like the 1 gigabyte plan for $20. I guess now it's 2 gigabytes, but I pay $20 a month for this convenience, which I don't use at home.
Yeah, yeah, and then you carry around SIM cards for everywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I don't keep them usually because the validity expires by the time I go back.
Mm-hmm.
So the only ones that I really keep in my little like compartment enclosure thing are this Orange card and my Verizon card when I pop it out of my Verizon phone, and then this T-Mobile card.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so not too many to keep track of then.
Yeah,
which is nice.
Yeah.
Have you ever run into a situation where you've gotten to a place and there's no internet, and now you're like clamoring for internet or somewhere to work? Has that ever happened?
No. Knock on wood. I will do research beforehand. So there's a site that I don't know. I think it's called Prepaid with Data something or other. It's this wiki site that people have contributed to that list out the different networks and different plans that are available for data connectivity. Mm-hmm. And so I will check those out just to make sure that things will work. But I also schedule my trips so that I usually fly out on a Friday night and I don't have to work till Monday. So I have all weekend and all of Monday morning to try to find a SIM card if I need to.
Yeah. Or a cafe.
I will say
right.
I'm just randomly thinking about this. I got a local SIM card in Brazil when I went a couple trips ago, and that was quite an experience, especially if you don't speak Portuguese.
Yeah, I believe
that was actually one that. Yeah, it was. I think they require like I think they ended up just accepting a copy of my passport. There was at one point they required you to be a local to get a SIM card, but that was one where I was very fortunate. I had an Airbnb situation. I asked the guys like, "Oh, where's the nearest store to get a SIM card?" As he was as I was checking in, he was showing me around the apartment, and he's like, he looked at me like with this sort of panicked look on his face. He's like, "Oh, here, let me take you and make sure it will work." And he actually walked me to the shop and explained to them what had to happen, and then told me everything was fine and walked away. And it's not clear that everything was fine, but he handled at least the initial negotiations for me. So that was challenging. But that was, I would say that was another one where like the shop where I got it wasn't open on Sunday. So it was I got it when I did.
Yeah.
Usually I will try not to go to countries that don't have the T-Mobile thing working, which also is a little bit limiting. But I do remember in Brazil, a friend did have to get me, a local friend had to get me my SIM card the first time. And the second time, someone else gave me a SIM card to use. So, yeah, I don't know what I would have done without, except lived on 2G for a week.
Wow. Sure. That would have been hard.
Yeah.
One of the topics you brought up when we were discussing the show was safaris. And so I think we could talk about that. And really, I want to know what it is that you're interested in. You sounded like you have done some safaris, but you're interested in a particular type of safari. And which one is that?
Yeah, so before I started this, I don't want to say travel as a lifestyle, but travel as a part of my lifestyle, I had to go to South Africa for work. And I thought, oh, well, I'll never make it to South Africa again, so I might as well splurge on a safari while I'm here. So I extended that work trip by a week, and I went on safari. And it was great. It was very expensive, but it was great. You know, the whole lodge experience where, you know, you have like butlers and they make you breakfast out in the savannah or out in the wild. And then you have like sundowners, which I had like a soda because I don't drink, but you know, I had a soda at sundown. But yeah, so I was thinking about this again because I was thinking about going to Kenya over Thanksgiving. Cause it's one of those places where if the internet ends up being really sucky, I'm only having to deal with it for 3 days. And then I still have 2 days where I don't have to worry about work. And so I was thinking about doing a safari in Kenya over the long weekend. And I was wondering if anyone had any experiences with the self-drive safari, which seems to be a lot cheaper. And I don't know if that is a better option. I assume it depends on what you like or what you want to get out of it and what you're willing to put into it and how rough you're willing to rough it. But yeah, so that those are my thoughts and questions about it.
Have you done a self-driven safari, Seth?
I've not done self-drive. I did one that was very similar to the Luxish thing John described, and it was in South Africa, out near Port Elizabeth, sort of a little eastern East Cape. And it was lovely with, you know, like you said, the guys mixing us drinks out on the savannah in the afternoons and evenings at sundown and all that stuff. The day we decided to, you know, push our luck and go out in the slight rain and got the truck stuck in the mud was less cool. especially because we were there off season and there was very few other people around to get us out. We spent a bit of time working on that. Hanging out next to the carcass of a dead animal, wondering what other animals were going to come over and feed on it while we were there. Yeah, it was cool. I haven't done it. I am skeptical. And, you know, I'm a cheap son of a bitch on a lot of these things. My skepticism comes from, I feel like, you know, to sort of know where you're going to be able to see the animals, which is why you're doing it, having someone who actually knows where they are and what the lay of the park is like is going to be more useful. And maybe you can sort of like do parts of it and then get day guides or something like that. I don't know. But I would wonder about that.
Okay. I can see that.
That's my concern.
Yeah. I remember this safari that, you know, they sort of knew where the animals were because of the season and because of previous sightings. And I would assume you don't get any of that information if you're doing a self drive. You're just kind of like driving around semi-aimlessly and
hoping to see something.
Right.
And I mean, I assume in the parks that you're in doing this sort of thing, there are roads and paths that you're supposed to stay on. So,
Whereas I remember these Jeeps would just go off-road, and I remember mowing down trees, and I felt so bad for the trees. And they would just, like, drive right over them, like nothing.
Okay, well, yours was a little different than mine, then. but, yeah, I mean, I do wonder, I mean, we did go off-road a little bit every now and then, but there are generally sort of pathways through the park. You don't just drive aimlessly. But I think that, you know, that would be my big concern is, you know, are you going to get to see the animals, and is it, you know, the same quality level of experience just because you're not doing it in a way that has that set of, you know, information going in.
Right.
And I think, you know, we can pose the question to our listeners and say, if anyone out there has done a self-drive safari, leave a comment or tweet Jonathan on Twitter.
Yeah, I feel like one of our other Steven friends has done it.
I wouldn't be surprised, actually. Yeah. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. So maybe we can hit him up and we'll have him send you a note.
Okay.
But I'm wondering, is there a particular country that you're looking at, or a particular park?
So I found a relatively decent deal to Kenya, so I'm thinking of something around there. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Makes sense.
I
think this, I'm sorry to change topics on you, but I think it kind of leads me to another question, because before the call, we have to share this with the listeners, you said, hang on a second, I'm about to buy this ticket. and where was it to?
This Kathmandu. Is my ticket to Kathmandu.
And we're like, I think Seth and I both just started laughing, but at the same time, we were like, that's genius. I want to know.
Hang on a second. I can't talk yet. I got to book this plane ticket. We've all been there, so I think the fact that you threw Kathmandu in as a specific destination was icing on the cake.
Which led me to think, how do you plan your travel? Because it sounds like you kind of are looking at stuff. You know, you're looking at stuff a few months in advance.
I look at stuff very in advance. I have almost every month planned for this year, and I know it's kind of ridiculous, but and it rarely, very rarely, has it come to bite me in the rump. It's whatever ticket is cheap and to a place that sounds interesting, I will go for it. Mm-hmm. And it has bit me in the rump a couple times, but work has been really gracious in paying for change fees or whatever, because the only reason I would cancel is because of work. And so I've actually had to cancel my vacation for March. I was actually going to take some time off work and go to Australia, which I've actually never been to, and that trip is now moved to September. So
wow. Yeah. Well, at least let you move it, and hopefully they took care of you. And
yeah
that's good.
So it's usually it's a lot of it is driven by price, because I really am open to seeing whatever part of the world will let me work from there.
Do you then travel, like, when you as you get closer to your travel date, are you then doing a lot more research on a particular destination, or do you kind of do that over the year and kind of compile, you know, things you want to see, things you want to do?
I am really bad at it.
You guys plan?
No, I think I used to be a lot more meticulous, because my mom is a very meticulous travel planner. Like, she makes spreadsheets, you know, with things planned out by day, and I sort of inherited that. But as time went on, I think I either became lazy or more laissez-faire about things. So I usually will get an overview of the city that I'm going to visit. I usually use, like, Wikivoyage or something, and I'll sort of see what's available, and I'll plan it out plan out days in my head, but like, okay, well, I can do this much on this day and this much on this day, but I won't even write it down what I plan to do. And because I'm usually in a city for quite a while, because I usually don't move in the middle of the week, it does open up a lot more flexibility. So I don't feel pressured to do everything in, like, the first day that I'm there or the second day, just to make sure I get things done, because I know I have the rest of the week to do it.
Yeah.
And usually on the weekends, I'll plan a day trip, and that's it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder, I think I'm very similar. I used to have sort of a massive spreadsheet of all the flights and the hotels and the details and all that sort of stuff, and I just don't do it anymore. I let whatever goes into trip, it helps, and then I sort of figure it out as I go along. But I wonder how much of that is just becoming more comfortable with the fact that, like, it turns out you're going to be fine when you get there, and there's stuff to see and do, and you'll see and do it, as opposed to, like, I got to know everything about where I'm going before I get there, because if I don't, I can't have a good time.
Yeah, I think I have become a lot less concerned about, or I've learned to not worry as much. I mean, I'm not that I was ever a big worrier, but I don't think that I was ever, or I think I've gotten more comfortable with myself in the way that I travel, in thinking, you know, if things don't work out, it's not going to be the last time that I'll ever have a chance to come here again. Knock on wood. So, you know, so I'm going to Serbia, I'm going to Belgrade this week or next week, and I really have no idea what's there. I one of my best friends in grad school was from there, so I'm finally visiting, because she was like, oh, you really should visit. And she doesn't live there anymore, but, you know, I'm finally visiting, but, you know, I vaguely know what's there, but I know that if things don't work out, like if it ends up raining all day and I don't feel like going out, then I'm okay living with that. And you know, I may miss out on something, but that doesn't mean I will never, ever, ever be able to go back again.
Sure. And I mean, my good recent example in a similar vein is I was in Lisbon at the beginning of January, shortly before we all did our recording in Porto, for, I guess, episode 100, and 101. Oops. And I literally knew nothing except that I booked Airbnb near the main castle because it seemed like, you know, there's a big castle, so being near that was a good idea. And until I got in the car from the airport to the apartment, I knew nothing about what I was going to see and do. And I let the guy driving me tell me about his city.
Mm.
And that formed my trip.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where you deduced that it was a giant hill?
Yes. as we sort of made switchbacks up to the apartment, I discovered that it wasn't my own. I don't know. I feel like, I mean, even this trip to Bangkok, I had my hotel booked because I was going to the conference, and I guess I'm at a conference. I don't really need to have much planned, but I'm going to Kuala Lumpur on Thursday, and I have no idea what I'm going to do there.
Whatever you want.
Well, yeah, but that may end up just like sit in a hotel room. I don't think so. I just don't know. I've got like 10 or 12 hours to kill before I'm on a red eye out on Thursday night, and I legitimately have no idea what I'm going to do. I got one recommendation of a restaurant from a buddy. I don't know where it is or what kind of food it is, but he sent me something, so I got to figure that out.
So it sounds like this has developed over the course of several years where our attitudes have changed or our approaches have changed. So it's not something that I think either of us started out.
Yeah, I absolutely didn't. The only thing about it that I question is, you know, I read something in one of the travel magazines once, back when I used to read those, and one of the stories was about sort of this sort of concept of planning and just how much effort do you put into it and what do you get out of it. And the only thing I sometimes think I miss out on is good dining options because I'm really bad at finding those on the fly.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
I will tell you this, and I've talked to you about this before, Seth. There's things like I want to keep, like there's like a tally, like I want to tag something to a city and be like, this I want to visit. And usually it involves food.
Yeah.
And so that for me, that's like a big thing. So I tag stuff on Pinboard or somewhere, Evernote, somewhere, with usually food is one tag and the other tag is the name of the city. And then I go back and look it up or I map it. Because I'm like you. I want, like, food is one. I love food. And I think, Jonathan, you love food too because you post about eating.
I love eating.
Which is another topic we should talk about. See, we've got like 3 hours of content here. But for me, it's like I want something local. I want something that I've heard someone talk about, or I want to try something new. And so those three kind of criteria, whenever I'm browsing the internet and that comes up and it meets those criteria, it's like bookmark, you know? And
yeah.
And that more than sights, I guess I get my travel pleasure from eating. It's terrible to say, I guess.
No
it's a wonderful thing to say.
Eating, I mean, and drinking.
I've seen enough temples. I'm sure there's some unique bits about the temples in Bangkok versus the temples in, you know, London. You know, churches are temples too, I guess.
But I think like most of the,
like, the food is more interesting to me.
Yeah, and I think you get some interesting conversation from it. So I just know, like, being in Poland, little grandmothers making pierogies and wondering why an American is in their restaurant and bringing over their grandchild to speak to us in English. So the
translation, yeah.
And being fascinated and wanting to tell us and basically inviting us into their home. I mean, they're making you something and it's very personal, you know?
We had something similar in Central Turkey and it was actually also little stuffed dumplings.
Unites the world.
That's one of those things that I feel like every culture has the same, like there's a few types of food that every culture has. One of them is a dumpling like that, you know, ravioli, pierogies, soup dumplings in Asia, like they're everywhere. But fried dough, usually sweetened, is another one.
Yep.
But anyway, I digress.
Tell me up on dinner time, I'm getting hungry.
and I'm about to go get breakfast, so there we go. But yeah, I think that the idea of, you know, being invited in and sort of getting that experience of, no, this is actually what we eat, not what we serve to the tourists, is interesting. And we actually had that in Turkey. We ordered Monty. We didn't know what it was, but the sort of the description sounded good. And the woman came out and like shook her head. No, we don't have this. We said, oh, okay, give me a minute. And we, you know, went back to the menu to figure more things out. And then the guy who owned the restaurant came out and he's like, what's wrong? And he said, oh, we wanted the Monty, but she said they don't have it. He's like, oh yeah, we do. It turns out it was one of the things. She was hand making them, and they were these tiny little dumplings. And I can imagine it was a massive amount of work, and she didn't want to waste them on the tourists.
Can you believe I know?
I mean, we got into some conversations, and when we showed appropriate love for them, everything worked out just fine. But yeah, she didn't want to waste them on the tourists because they were too much work.
Well, I'm glad that guy was there.
Yeah,
well, I actually know what Monty is from the Istanbul Lounge.
Yeah, it's the only. That's your only experience is from the Istanbul Lounge with Monty.
Oh, no, eating Monty. Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Yeah. The stuff they serve in the Turkish Lounge in Istanbul is pretty good. I mean, the stuff we had was in Central Turkey. was definitely better, but I think the stuff I've had it in the Turkish lounge in Istanbul as well. It's pretty good. Solid representation.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan, you're a bit of a photographer as well, and you'll kind of be on Instagram, and it's fascinating because you'll post 6 or 7 photos kind of in a row, and it's kind of like your walk through your day almost. So I can't remember which one it was when I was following kind of live. I woke it up and I was like opening up Instagram, and you were in somewhere in the Middle East, and you were posting like archways and doors. And it was gorgeous. It was like following you through the city and just what caught your eye. So what do you look for when you're traveling? I mean, are you looking specific for something specific, or are you just kind of walking the city and just taking your time and viewing things and saying, you know, that'd make a good shot?
Yeah. So my dad he's now retired. He was a professional photographer, and I don't know if I inherited the eye or whatever they call it from him. But I remember a quote somewhere. I think this famous photographer, and I can't remember her name. I'm pretty sure it was a she. She said, like, a photographer's job is to put a frame around things that we see. And it's just whatever catches my eye, whatever I think is compelling. I used to put a lot more effort into taking photos. Like, I used to carry around a DSLR or, you know, something like that. And now I carry around a point and shoot, which I hardly use. I usually just use my phone now. And as you said, a lot of my pictures end up on Instagram. I feel kind of bad because I will post sometimes like 6 or 7, maybe up to 10 pictures in a row, like during the course of my morning when I'm out exploring before I have to work. And it's usually things that catch my eye. Sometimes, like you said, I'll get on a theme, and, you know, if certain archways or doorways or windows catch my eye, then, yeah, I'll post a bunch of those.
I don't think you should feel bad about posting 10 photos to Instagram, because I think it's one, it's indicative of what you're doing that day, and I think it's beautiful. And so if people don't like that, they can unfollow you. But you know, whatever.
Thanks.
Fuck them.
Exactly.
We're allowed to say it once and stay PG-13. So just no more.
Good to know. But yeah, I am actually a really bad Instagrammer in that. I will post a lot, but because I'm so busy in the mornings, I have really like little time to go through and like the photos from people that I follow as well, which is actually really bad for me. So if you want me to like your photos, post it, like send a link to Twitter, because then I'll always click on it. But yeah, usually if it's in the app, it's hard for me to go through while I'm walking around and like pictures. But yeah.
Yeah. And so you just carry
I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You're actually out there exploring in the real world as opposed to vicariously.
That's true.
So you carry a point and shoot. You don't really use it that much. So you kind of travel pretty light then, I would assume.
I do. I carry around certain things with me all the time. Like I carry around my point and shoot. I carry around an external battery pack for my phone. I actually carry two. Sunglasses, an umbrella if it's rainy, and some wet wipes. That's pretty much it.
Tips for our listeners. Things you need.
And, oh, actually, it's the things that I carry around a lot. Something I forgot I carry around with me is a reusable shopping bag, because I realized over the course of staying in many Airbnbs and going to supermarkets that I've been paying 2 cents a bag, like, so many times over. So I do carry around one of those as well.
Yeah.
I do that, too. It's also useful when coming home and my bag gets too full, I can offload some stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
But, yeah. And they make some nice, like, collapsible ones that sort of, like, fold up into themselves with a drawstring, so they're tiny.
Yeah.
But, I'm curious, you know, talking about some of the photography stuff you've done, one of the themes in your travels is very similar. I'm actually looking out the window of this Hilton in Bangkok down onto what was an abandoned warehouse space. And it's now been completely reconstructed into, like, modern hipster, wishes it was Portland kind of food and crafts and stuff like that. So it's no longer abandoned space, but you do a lot of exploring, or have in the past done a lot of exploring of abandoned spaces.
And yeah.
What drew you to that, and how do you find them? Because, you know, they're abandoned, which means no one goes there. So how do you know where they are?
Right. So I am one of those people that are somehow attracted to decay and ruin and abandonment. So people call it ruin porn for people like us who enjoy it, like just staring at like ruined buildings or decaying buildings. And, yeah, so I usually just end up trying to Google places. Like, I'll Google the city name and then abandon and see what comes up. And I've actually made some trips out of visiting abandoned places. So I believe it was Latvia that I went around. I like rented a car and went to abandoned places, got stuck in the sand in one place, and that was a big mess, and I thought I would like die there. Like out in the middle of nowhere trying to go to an abandoned like missile silo or something, which I actually never made it to because I was digging my car out of the sand. But anyways, it's a little bit tough, especially lately, because I do have to get back to places, or I do have to get back for work, so it's hard for me to devote a lot of time to exploring abandoned places. So I usually will try to do it over a weekend, or like the Saturday that I have before I fly home Sundays. That's usually my schedule. But it's been a while since I've done it, but there's just something about abandoned places that I can't get enough of. I don't think it's necessarily the thrill of sneaking into them or like thinking that I'm doing something illegal, which I think in some cases it might be because you're technically trespassing. But there's a beauty to it that I can't explain. If you don't appreciate it, then it's sort of hard to convince you to appreciate it.
Yeah, I've seen a couple of features. I think I sent you the one of the bus stops, the former Soviet bus stops.
Yes.
I thought that was one of the more beautiful examples of urban decay. I mean, mm-hmm. these bus stops out in the middle of nowhere in some cases that were built in this grand Soviet era style. That were just no longer being used.
Were these stations or like just random individual bench on the side of the road?
Basically stops. Yeah, they were benches.
Yeah, they're benches with like enclosures around them, like a little shed. But they're like concrete sheds that are in like brutalist, like random, like realist, like angular or circular. They're crazy geometric shapes.
If you still have the link, send it to me. We'll put it in the show notes. That sounds really cool.
Absolutely, yeah. They would have these huge ones that were, you know, it's there for 10 people or whatever, but it's this massive concrete, very angular structure. And you're like, wait a second, they built this for, you know, the 10 people that are waiting for the bus in the middle of Kazakhstan. And now it sits here empty because that bus no longer runs or whatever reason. And so it's a really cool look at, one, the past. And I think it's interesting to see how, one, I think it's fascinating how things decay. You know, watching a building being taken back over. So I enjoy your photography when you take some of the urban explorer, exploration porn, as you call it.
Yeah, thanks. It's been too long since I've done it, so I really do need to try to step that up, if only for myself, because I there's this pleasure that I get out of it that, I don't know, I just love the seeing the state of things now, imagining how it was back in the heyday when, I don't know, like, for instance, this abandoned textile factory that I went to, what life would have been like back then, and how nature has taken over. So, like, the branches coming through the windows and so on. So, mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite abandoned place?
So my favorite one, I guess, is sort of this maybe typical generic answer because it's sort of easy to get to. Well, not easy to get to, but Pripyat near Chernobyl. Mm-hmm. Because the people left in such a rush that there's still signs of, there are signs that people were still there. So like you can tour, like you have like, when you go on a Pripyat Chernobyl tour, you basically, they take you to these stops and you can sort of wander at your will. And so one of these stops is like a school. So still they have like the workbooks out, the posters out, the learning materials out. I mean, they're scattered all over the floors and such, but it's sort of a moment in time that, even though it's been a couple decades and everyone has traipsed through it, it's still quite an amazing place for me. And I do have a soft spot, I think, for former Soviet things as well, and that's something I also can't explain, like how I love ruined porn. But I have a soft spot for former USSR countries, and I don't know why.
Yeah. Have you ever been to the UFO building? And I call it the UFO building, the one in Bulgaria. That's
no, no. I see so many pictures, and I would love to rent a car and just drive out there one day and do it.
I think that's the most intimidating part of it, is it's not close to anything in particular. You have to have a car to get to it, and so
right. And after my experience in Latvia, I. Long story short, there's a national park, and it's built, the national park evolved from this old Russian missile site, and you can drive out to the site, but my car got stuck in the sand. I was trying to dig my car out for like 3 hours, and I had like barely any cell phone reception. I was Googling like how to like get your car out of sand. And then I thought to myself, oh, maybe I can call like the American Express concierge service and have them send a helicopter, because I'm just going to die out here because no one's out here.
not even a tow truck. You were just going to go straight to helicopter?
Pretty much. I was so like delirious at that point. But luckily, like, these, like, workers, like, park workers, not even rangers, like, workers came by, and they spoke a little German because they worked for a German company, and I spoke a little German because I used to live in Germany, and they managed to, like, hitch a rope up to my rental car and, you know, pry it out of, or, like, yank it out of the sand. And so I spent the rest of the afternoon, like, I stopped at a random hotel, like, on the side of the road saying, yeah, my car broke down, and I had to, like, fix the flat tire, and so now I'm all dirty, so can I just pay you $10 to take a shower?
Wow.
Which I did, because I was, like, a mess. I was, like, a sandy, muddy mess. And I spent the rest of the day, like, I went to the supermarket, bought baby wipes, and, like, wiped down the interior of the car because I had trekked sand in it. Like, by trying to, like, get my car out of the sand, I kept going back in to try to, you know, turn the car on and, you know, try to get the car out. So it was full of sand all over the place. The outside was a mess, but luckily it also rained for 10 minutes. So I got the outside clean. I got the inside clean. I got my full deposit back because I had to pay the deposit in cash because for some reason this Latvian company, like the credit card company or the credit card wouldn't work or something. So,
wow.
Yeah. So long story short, all's well that ends well.
So you're a little leery of taking cars now.
I am a little leery.
Oh man. I was trying to think, there was one other thing I think we were talking about photography, and we were talking about just, you know, you kind of travel light. You also don't really subscribe to an alliance anymore as far as airlines.
Yeah, so that sort of changed when all these devaluations happened. And I used to be a United person, so I was 1K for a couple of years, and now I'm pretty much nothing. I didn't even make silver last year, and I'm totally okay with it. And I'm just going to continue flying cheap flights. And yeah, so I actually flew my first Oneworld long haul. My first American Airlines long haul for the first time last month in like a decade. So that was interesting because the plane was exactly the same. No new screens, no Wi-Fi, no power plugs, but yeah.
Oh, so you're on one of the old 760s?
I was on the old 777-200s.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and I was really surprised because I would think that they would have like entertainment on demand, but it was like the next showing is in 20 minutes.
Yeah, I get to fly on one of those at the end of the week, so. Okay.
Yeah, and so I was mostly Star Alliance, and it's actually going to be hard to say goodbye to Star Alliance because there's a relatively big presence in San Francisco where I am, and yeah.
Yeah, that's tough. I mean, it's tough because,
well, you're not like saying you can't use them anymore. It's just that you're not going to focus on them.
Right.
And you just recently did the United Island Hopper, which Seth and I and the other hosts of this show failed miserably at.
But you had a great story out of it.
But you went all the way through, and you even continued on to Manila, correct?
I did. So I did the stops all the way to Guam, like the maximum number of stops to Guam, and then I also stopped one stop on the way to Manila as well.
Wow, right?
Yeah.
You got a lot of nice lines out of that trip.
Yeah, and I felt really bad for the guy sitting next to me who was coming home to Guam from Washington State where he had spent the holidays, and he developed a toothache on the way back, and he was in so much pain the whole time, and he missed his flight, so the agent in wherever he was in Washington, I'm not sure where he started, rebooked him on this flight from Honolulu to Guam with the five stops, and didn't know that it was the Island Hopper, and he could have been at home in half the time.
Oh my God.
With the Island Hopper going home with a toothache, so every time we take off, like, once the seatbelt sign went off, he'd go to the bathroom and, like, hide there for, like, 10 minutes because it hurt so bad. I felt so bad for him.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
Man. I think the last thing, we kind of talked about food a little bit. I don't want to keep you on the call too long, but we talked about food a little bit. But something that came up on Twitter just recently was McDonald's. And you eat at McDonald's overseas kind of regularly. And it makes it sound like a bad thing, but it's not a bad thing. Because you and Jason Rabinowitz, who we've had on the show before, brought up a great point that McDonald's around the world are kind of different and kind of have a little bit of local culture in them. So it's kind of a easy way to like tip your toe into it and see what the food is like.
Yeah, and if you follow me on Twitter, you know that I love junk food and I eat fast food all the time, even at home. And so I don't really see any reason not to when abroad, especially if you can focus on things that you wouldn't be able to get at home. So I don't go and eat like a Big Mac or whatever. You know, I'm not gonna eat like a quarter pounder or a Big Mac or chicken nuggets unless there's like a special sauce. But you know, there are certain things that you can get at McDonald's overseas that you can't get here, and I'll usually try those just because it's like what people eat. So there are like these desserts in Romania that I think they're called like papanashi or something like that. I'm probably butchering it, but there are certain desserts you can get, and they serve them at McDonald's. I figured, why not?
Yeah.
And yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I will say we've also had Ed Pizza on the show a few times. He too subscribes to the McDonald's as a sample of local culture. Usually through the chicken fingers or chicken tenders or chicken drumsticks or whatever approach, because like John said, there's always different sauces and interesting things like that.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people like downplay it. They say, oh, well, you don't eat at McDonald's, eat local. Well, you know, for a meal every now and then, yeah, sure. But sometimes you're working or you just want a snack when you're out on the road. I mean,
it is local.
It is local. And you know what's funny to me is I would go to McDonald's sometimes in Western Europe because they put ice in the drinks. And that sounds terrible, but you go to Europe in the middle of the summer when it's, you know, 90 degrees out, there's no AC, and you feel like you're dying. Everyone else is eating ice cream, but you know what? I want a soda with some ice in it, and that makes me happy.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't eat it every meal. I usually have it once, at most twice in a week. Mm-hmm. And I'm not averse to trying, like, local fast food chains either, so
yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. John, can I ask you a relatively personal question?
Sure.
What's your annual Easy Mac budget?
So a while back, I got an Amazon Dash button just because I thought it was a cool idea. And I really didn't use any of the other products, but there was one for craft. And so if you don't know what it is, it's like this little like keychain size remote that you can put in your cupboard or in your pantry or whatever. And when you run low, you push this button and it orders something that you set up in the app. So I have it set up to order Easy Mac, which is mac and cheese that you can just microwave in like 3 minutes. it's actually not so bad. I would assume I probably spend like $80 a year on it.
Okay. So not horribly unreasonable. I think you tweeted about it last week and I saw it again. I just started laughing to myself and I remembered you were going to be on. I had to know.
Yeah. Well, it comes in like 24 and I'll usually eat maybe like one or two a week. So
as a man who appreciates a nice box of cheese and shells, I understand this. I should get an Easy Button. Now I'm intrigued.
And why not?
It's Pandora's box.
It ships Prime even though it doesn't meet the requirements, because that's one of the benefits of having one of these buttons.
It ships Prime too. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And I bet being in San Francisco, they probably have a distribution warehouse somewhere nearby, so you get it in a day rather than 2 days. That's awesome.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie, that happens. Which is fine with me.
That's great.
Nice. All right.
Well, I think that's a great show, and I really want to thank you, Jonathan, for coming on the show and joining us and sharing a little bit about your travel habits, your lifestyle, and just your enjoyment of being on the road.
Oh, thank you again for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and if you want to follow Jonathan on Twitter, his Twitter handle is @JONK, junk, and I believe it's the same on Instagram as well.
Yeah.
And
Snapchat?
Not Snapchat, because I was very late to the game. I think I only started half a year ago. So it's JO_NK, but you can get all that from my Twitter profile. It's all listed there.
Perfect. Perfect. And you have a blog as well, which is great.
I do, but I'm actually really bad at it now. I've gotten kind of lazy.
Well, I think it's worth it for our listeners to go and read your old post too.
Oh, thank you.
So, thanks for listening to the show. If you want to follow Dots, Lines, and Destinations on Twitter, it's @DotsLines. If you want to leave us a comment on iTunes, we'd really appreciate that. And thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.